Greetings, and welcome to the Virtus Duff & Phelps Real Assets Outlook Portfolio Insights call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, June 17th, 2020. I would now like to turn the conference over to Barry Mandenak, Head of Distribution. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Barry Mandenak. I am Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners, and I want to welcome you all to the Virtus Portfolio Insights call featuring David Grumhouse, Co-CIO of Duff & Phelps Investment Management. As a reminder, Duff & Phelps is an affiliate of Virtus Investment Partners, and Duff & Phelps pursues specialized investment strategies in real assets. David leads the investment teams involved in the global real estate and global listed infrastructure and energy strategies. David, I want to welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Barry. Glad to be here.
Okay, good. Well, I'll start off with a few questions. Please go on as expansively as you'd like. We'll then turn it open to the field for some additional questions, and then we'll wrap it up. You know, we'll start off with the obvious, with COVID-19 having a significant impact on the global stock, bond, and commodities markets. But more specifically, what do you talk about and think about as it relates to COVID-19 and its effect on real assets?
Thanks, Barry. The effect on real assets has really been mixed. The traditional real assets tied to inflation, things like commodities, natural resources, and TIPS, have certainly been hurt by the deflation that we've seen. When we think about the real asset sectors that Duff focuses on, so this is global real estate, global listed infrastructure, and midstream energy, the impacts have really varied. Both global REITs and global listed infrastructure have been weighed down by a couple of tough sectors. For real estate, it has been retail, lodging, and to some extent, urban office. For global listed infrastructure, it has really been transportation, and by this we mean mainly international airports and toll roads and midstream energy. Of course, what this ignores is that the performance of the majority of the subsectors in both global real estate and global listed infrastructure have been really strong. Right now, with the summer upon us and most states reopening back up, the recovery is feeling a little bit more like a V-shape, but we think it will be more of a square root shape with a smaller V and then a while to get back to normal. And as this happened and as the don't fight the Fed mode rolls off, we think both sectors will look increasingly attractive. The market is really underappreciating the visibility of the earnings that these sectors really have.
So from David, given where we are, I know the real estate market in particular, many people thought it was more of a defensive play in the markets and didn't kind of play out quite that way, but I know it's rallied quite a bit from the bottom. Where do you see the key risks at this point, and what opportunities do you see for global REITs on a go-forward basis?
So global REITs are down about 19% year-to-date, you know, meaningfully trailing the broader market. Admittedly, as you said, they were not as defensive as we would have hoped. We have seen a lot of bad headlines around retail, lodging, and urban office. But it's important not to let the tail wag the dog here. The REIT sector has really changed over the last decade. And these subsectors only make up 25% of the overall index, both on a U.S. and global basis. There are 11 other subsectors out there, and a number of them think, you know, data centers, cell towers, industrial logistics, single-family housing are actually seeing accelerated growth with shelter in place, and the stocks have done well. We think this is a very good entry point for REITs. The valuation is attractive. Most of the sector is not just resilient, but still generating real earnings growth. REITs are also trading at a meaningful discount to private net asset values. This has been a good indicator for outperformance in the past, and while the discount has shrunk with the bounce to roughly half of the 25% discount that we saw back in March, the sector still has a lot of room to run. Another thing I would point out is that both U.S. REIT and global REIT are generating yields, you know, close to 4%, which should be increasingly well regarded as the central banks keep rates low and investors search for yield. Finally, I would say, you know, with such a dichotomy in how the subsectors are trading, active managers should be able to generate real alpha here. Our global REIT performance has been stellar, with not only top decile performance since inception, but also outstanding Sharpe ratios and upside and downside capture.
So if I was just, you know, playing devil's advocate, thinking about clients that are out there thinking about a REIT investment, they're looking at many, many companies in a work-from-home environment rethinking their footprint in terms of commercial real estate and office buildings and locations and so forth. And you've kind of answered it to some degree, but I just want to kind of reiterate this point again. From your perspective, if somebody says, hey, David, investing in real estate now, given what's happening with work from home and people rethinking their footprint on commercial real estate, why do REITs still make sense to you?
Again, Barry, I would point to the fact that when, you know, we think of real estate and we think of real estate traditionally, we think of, you know, retail apartments and mall, retail apartments and office. But the sector is really much, much bigger than that. You know, at this point, retail and office and lodging only make up roughly 25% of the overall sector. That other 75% is in different new sectors, some of which are very much technology-driven, and again, some of which have really benefited from the work from home, stay-in-place orders. So if you think about, again, you know, cell towers, if you think about data centers, they're seeing their businesses just really take off as a result of what's been happening. And even some of the other categories, things like, you know, self-storage has been really strong, industrial. And when we think about that, we think about warehouse and logistics. Obviously, with everything going on with home delivery and with what the expansion that Amazon's seen, you know, those types of businesses are really doing well. So there's a lot more to the REIT sector and to the real estate sector than what we think about traditionally, and a lot of those businesses are really booming right now.
Yeah, and I thought that was so important. It was kind of worth reiterating again, because what we see so often that happens in this market with, you know, people drowning in information is the so-called baby gets thrown out with the bathwater from time to time. And so the whole real estate market, which historically, as you point out, has been a more defensive way to be in equities than other ways, didn't hold up quite as well here because many people just kind of thought all real estate's being rethought as a consequence of COVID-19. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that.
And your point that you made about downside capture, I do note that VGISX, the global real estate fund of ours, has a upside-downside capture ratio since inception of about 83 on the upside and 68 on the downside. And many advisors that I speak with are trying to search to how to create income for life through retirement, real income, in fact, and do it for risk-averse people who historically look to fixed income but with paltry yields are forced to consider equities now. Does the contractual nature of the cash flow that comes through the REIT portfolios here help an FA think about kind of smoother ride access to the equity markets for these types of investors?
I think absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the points that I was trying to make at the beginning is I think people don't appreciate the visibility and the resiliency of the earnings you have here. I mean, you have set assets in most cases. You have long-term contracts. And, you know, and that's not only in global real estate, but also in global listed infrastructure. And I think that those earnings and those contracts lead to very stable earnings and very stable cash flows that really tend to do well and do help you on the defensive side. But also because of some of these new sectors and some of the growth, really also capture some of the upside as well.
Okay. Now, on global listed infrastructure, what's your perspective there in terms of is now the time to incorporate it in an allocation for a risk-averse investor needing global equity exposure?
I think it's absolutely a good time to incorporate an allocation. I'd say, you know, the story is similar to REITs. Global listed infrastructure offers a great mix of protection and cyclical upside to a recovery. You have a generally defensive strategy backed by long-term contracts and, again, steady cash flows that was really upended by COVID-related impacts on two subsectors, namely the global transportation and the midstream energy. You know, you have to remember that 50% of the sector is U.S. and global utilities, each of which have traded generally in line with the market, but probably should be trading better, especially against the backdrop of massively falling interest rates. Utilities, from a business perspective, should not see much of any impact from COVID. They will continue to benefit from higher investment in the sector. Much of this being driven by the move towards renewables and clean energy. Recent example, that the $750 billion euro recovery plan that was announced in the end of May, that is loaded with green energy investments that will really benefit a number of the utilities over in Europe. The relative PEs for utilities with the market have fallen meaningfully over the last few months, with U.S. forward PEs going from sort of 1.25x the market to 0.9. I would also note that the U.S. utility sector is one of the few sectors that should really be insulated from the U.S. elections. The market doesn't seem really worried about U.S. elections right now, but I think as we get closer and if a Democratic sweep still seems to be materializing, utilities will be a really good place to be. You know, they are one of the few sectors that will not be impacted by higher tax rates. They weren't impacted when tax rates came down. They won't be impacted when tax rates go up. And also the inevitable green energy push that you might get with a Democratic sweep would be great for them. Going beyond the utilities, communication stocks I've touched on, communication stocks, a lot of the towers are the one area that sort of go back and that are in both the REITs and in the global listed infrastructure. Tower stocks have done phenomenally well. The higher bandwidth that's needed to support people from working from home has been a boon for these stocks, and we're seeing, just continued investment there and growth. Now, look, COVID-19 has definitely hurt the transportation and midstream stocks, but their valuations already reflect this, and they both provide some nice cyclical upside to go alongside the utilities if things get better. There's a lot of bad priced in, and again, they will do well if the economy recovers. Look at the transportation stocks. They are essentially monopolies. Whether you own a toll road in Italy or an airport in Australia, there's no other place to go. And people will start to drive and fly again, and traffic will inevitably come their way. And the valuations really aren't reflecting that. Finally, again, you're getting very attractive yields here with good defensive cash flows combined with some cyclical upside if the economy rebounds.
Okay, I'm going to ask a last question, and then we're going to open it up for others. But many people think, to buy real estate or to buy infrastructure, real assets of any sort, energy, you need inflation to do well. For those that don't see inflation on the horizon, who have convinced about lower for longer and all, why do these investments still make sense in that type of an environment?
Inflation is clearly MIA right now. There's no question about it. And yes, the broader real asset category, and again, when I would get back to sort of the commodities and the tips and some of the natural resources, those stocks tend to need inflation, and you've seen it historically. They've done very well in inflationary periods. However, I would say with the extreme central bank easing and the government stimulus, deflation could turn to inflation. Which would obviously be really good for these stocks. Now, having said that, I think when we look specifically at the global REITs or global listed infrastructure, they don't need that inflation. They've got good growth without it. They have the added benefit that if inflation does happen, they do have these contracts, most of which have annual step-ups in them, so they do offer some inflation protection. But I think both these sectors do well with or without inflation, and both have again pulled back to the point where you're getting a pretty good entry.
Okay, great. With that, operator, I'd like to open it up for questions, please.
Absolutely. Thank you. And our first question comes from the line of Ethan Lowen. Your line is now open. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you. Very informative. I guess my question is about inflation. I guess what do you think the odds are of inflation, and what would be different this time around as opposed to, the last 10, 12 years? Or is it just the sheer amount of stimulus that you think is making the difference or could make the difference
Ethan, and I think it's a really good question, because I think if you polled most of us 5 years ago, certainly no one would expect rates where they are today, but I don't even think people would have expected rates, you know, to stay below 3%. So inflation really hasn't been there, and that's really been a function of wage growth, I think, and or the lack thereof. And look, with unemployment having spiked back up, I think you're right that it's hard to think that we're going to see big inflation in the near term, certainly not in the next, you know, 12 months and probably longer. But I think your point is the right one. Just the sheer magnitude of the spending that's going on, both on a, you know, both what from a central bank basis as well as from a federal government basis, we've gone beyond what was done during the great financial crisis in terms of both the magnitude, but how quickly it is. I think that, you know, thankfully the great financial crisis paved the way to teach us, to teach both the Federal Reserve and the central banks and the government how to pass these bills and to move them forward. And so it was a lot easier this time, but as a result, we will really have put a, just in a massive amount of stimulus out there. And I think it's likely to continue. And I do think at some point there's a decent chance that we get inflation out of it. You know, I've been wrong before about inflation, so I'm certainly not going to put a stake in the ground. But I think as you look out, you know, multiple years, there's certainly a very good chance that it could show back up.
That certainly makes sense, I guess. Are you kind of describing almost an environment of stagflation, I guess, where inflation isn't occurring because of wage growth, but just by the sheer devaluation of currencies? Is that what you're seeing as a possibility?
I think you could see that, and you know, I think you could eventually see wage growth. I mean, obviously, you're not going to see it at the unemployment rates that we're seeing now, but just the level of stimulus and the level of cheap money that's there, you do wonder whether things could overheat. And I think even more than in the great financial crisis or what we've seen over the last few years, you know, both the Fed, both the central banks, and the government are pretty overextended. So their ability to control it if it starts to happen is probably not going to be there. So you're exactly right. The last 5 or 6 years would certainly, or 7 years would certainly tell us that maybe inflation's not going to be here, and we're going to look more like Japan. But I do think that there's a chance that this switches over and it starts to go. And if it does start to go, it's, as I said, I think it's going to be hard to stop.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of James Bush. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, David. Thanks so much for doing this call. We've obviously been talking quite a bit about stimulus, and the White House is rumored to be prepping nearly $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. So I just wanted to see if you had some thoughts on, you know, government infrastructure spending and implications for REITs in the infrastructure space.
Sure. You know, I think when we think about the infrastructure bill, obviously there have been rumors out there about it. Don't have a great feel of how to handicap it. You know, I think Trump and his advisors are trying to figure out, obviously they're trying to get the economy on track and want to do it. The Republican senators seem against it. So I don't put, I'd say, you know, less than 50-50 odds that we get something done before the election. I think actually the chances of one goes up post-election. But if we're talking, you know, what does it mean for infrastructure stocks if this gets done? What I would say about when you see these government infrastructure bills is they tend to be more about roads and bridges, and in the U.S. almost always done by governments and municipalities and states. It doesn't tend to have a huge effect directly on the infrastructure stocks, listed infrastructure stocks that we own. It does tend to help with sentiment, but in terms of being an earnings driver for these companies, it doesn't tend to be a direct effect. Now, having said that, there are selective pockets within global listed infrastructure that will benefit from this. So, you know, think railroads. Certainly, if you get a big infrastructure spend, you're going to be moving a lot of steel and cement and other stuff around, and the railroads will see pickups in that. It may help on midstream, right? And admittedly, you know, the Democrats are pretty anti-midstream and anti-energy, but you may get some help there. Utilities will definitely benefit. You know, utilities are an easy place for the government to send money and get it spent and increase jobs. And I think especially when you think about clean energy and renewables, I think any infrastructure bill would have additional incentives around clean energy and
you know, renewables, be it solar, wind, offshore wind, and that will go directly to the utilities. So the utilities would certainly be an area that might get help here. You know, maybe you could see something on the privatization side in the U.S. Again, a lot of the infrastructure that we talk about on a transportation or an airport basis is really in Europe and Asia. We don't do a lot of that here. You know, there are a couple private toll roads and airports in the U.S., but generally we as a country have shied away from that. Maybe that changes, but I think it probably would be a, you know, small and not a big driver.
Excellent. Thank you for bearing with me as my dog ate a neighbor here. Great.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Don Murphy. Please go ahead.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking the call today and for the chance to ask you questions directly. Would you touch on the discount to NAV and your thoughts on it, please? In real estate, obviously, in retail.
Yeah. You know, this is something that we've paid a lot of attention to for a while. And, you know, what we found is when that discount to NAV, you know, widens out past outside of 10%, the stocks going back the last 30 years have really outperformed. So it's sort of a technical measure that we watch very closely. And, you know, at the peak of the drop in the market, so back in March, that discount had widened out almost to 25%. And we'd only seen it at that level a couple times over the last 30 years, you know, great financial crisis, 1999. And any time we've seen it, we've seen really strong performance in real estate, in the REITs, once it hits that. Now, we've seen that gap, as I mentioned, sort of close in half. So if we were at 25 today, we're closer to 12. So we've seen some of that. We've certainly seen some of that close as the REITs have bounced. But having said that, if you look at the chart, it's not very often below 10%, and we're still below 10. And when it's been above 10, we've continued to see very strong forward performance. So we think it's a good metric to watch, and we think it continues to be a good indicator and you know, a good reason why we think valuations here are still attractive.
Thank you.
David, while we wait for the next question, a lot of people are talking about the fact that in this market, in a post-COVID world, that there are more winners and losers than the kind of rising tide that lifted all boats market that we saw for much of the last decade. From your perspective, you know, you compete with other firms, many of whom have much bigger asset bases than you do. How do you see the size of Duff & Phelps and your ability to implement best ideas relative to your competition?
You know, I think there's an advantage to being a little smaller. I think certainly as I look at our teams, we have a lot of history together. You know, I, for instance, I look at the REIT team, you know, the our two lead portfolio managers, Jeff Divis and Frank Haggerty have been together for 14 years. We have two senior analysts on that team who've been working with Jeff and Frank for 13 and 12 years respectively. We're a global focus, but we're all together in the same office. And I think that team experience together is fairly unique and probably would only work, you know, would only work in a relatively smaller shop like ours. And, you know, I'd say the same thing about the global listed infrastructure team, that we've got a lot of time together and a very close team that can work very closely together. And I think that the advantage of that is that, you know, we're meeting with each other formally every week and constantly, you know, throughout the week, even if it's now being done virtually. And that really does allow the PMs and the analysts to establish very good communication and be able for the analysts to really get their best ideas up in front of the PMs. And I think, you know, at bigger shots and bigger firms, I don't think it works that way. I think it's can be much more formal, and I think the process isn't as tight as that what we have. And I think that shows in the performance we've had, and it goes back to, you know, bear your points about the upside and downside capture. I think because we get those best ideas in there and that we can react a little quicker, that really does help us both on the downside and on the upside.
Great. Any other questions, operator?
Yes, and once again, as a reminder, if you would like to register for a question, please press 1-4. Our next question comes from the line of Mike Feldman. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, David. Question. I was wondering if you could speak to just the sector composition within the REIT space and how that's changed over the years.
Sure, Mike. Thanks for the question. I think when you think about REITs, and I touched on this a little bit in my remarks, but when we think about REITs, we think about sort of the traditional real estate sectors of, and when you look back when this started, it was really apartments, it was office, and it was retail, really just malls. And a little bit why the sector's been hurt is because I think that's the way a lot of people still think about it. But this sector has grown incredibly. You know, you've got 14 different sectors now. Many of them are in areas that are a little bit different than just sort of your standard buildings. You know, I talk about the technology aspects on the data centers. Obviously, we've seen just phenomenal growth there. I think you think about industrial logistics. There's always been some industrial, but I think, you know, the importance of industrial has grown tremendously as we've seen so much more e-commerce. You get into stuff like healthcare and self-storage, and then, you know, the specialty around the cell towers. And the sector, it's just grown tremendously, and the makeup of it is very different than what I think if you went to the average person and said, you know, tell me what's in the REIT sector and what makes it up. Again, I think people would be very surprised that retail is only less than 10% of the sector and office is only 15% of the sector and, you know, lodging is like 1% of the sector. So it really has changed a lot. And I think a lot of the newer businesses have a lot more growth and have much stronger secular growth stories around them than maybe some of the traditional real estate that people think of.
Thank you for that.
And our next question comes from the line of Conrad Hyort. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah, could you just run through the differences between the global real estate, international real estate, and real estate, and not only the differences, but if we're looking at adding a position to portfolios for clients that don't have any real estate specific, what would you suggest, where do we head and how do we explain the differences and how do we lead there?
Sure. I mean, I would think about U.S. is just U.S., so you're really just concentrating on the U.S. markets. You have a little bit, the overall makeup of the sector isn't dramatically different, but you know, you have a little bit of different subsectors. If you think international, then you're just doing the international, no U.S., and then global is really a mixture of the two. So from a perspective of, just to give you an idea, if we think of global is about 55% U.S., Canada is another 4%, so you know maybe it's a little bit under 60% North America, and so that may give you some feel. In terms of, you know, where would you invest, you know, I would say I would probably either do U.S. REIT or global REIT. I think the global is pretty interesting in the sense that the U.S. market's probably a little bit more fully valued, and maybe global gives you a little bit more exposure that way. I think global also, if you're worried about the U.S. elections, it may give you a little bit more diversification from that. I think in terms of the U.S., why we like the U.S. is it's proven to be a very stable market. It also has a little bit more of the technology and newer sectors in it. So data centers is a higher percent in U.S. than it would be in the global. And so from that perspective, some of the more technology, if you're looking for a little bit more technology angle, the U.S. is probably a better place to be. But, you know, overall, I would say from a yield perspective, they're pretty similar, and they've traded fairly close to each other recently.
Thank you, and there are no further questions at this time.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank you all for taking the time out of your day to join us. For additional market commentary and portfolio-specific insights, please visit our website at vertus.com. If you have any additional questions or would like further information, please feel free to give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. David, I'd like to thank you again for your time today. Very helpful. I think everybody here got a very good flavor for the underlying benefits of investing in both global real estate and global infrastructure. I see it as two terrific ways to position risk-averse investors, near-retired or retired investors, in a more defensive way to get global equity exposure with long-term durable cash flow characteristics that can really help provide smoother ride access to the equity markets that these people desperately need exposure to fund their retirement income and to make sure they don't outlive their capital by sitting too much on the sidelines, as we know there's record cash out there. So, David, thank you again for your time, and thanks, everybody else, and have a great, safe evening.